Welcome to the Black Health Perspective, where we'll talk about our health from our perspective. I'm your host, Millicent Duncan.
And I'm your co-host, Brian Duncan.
Episode 7.
Number 7.
Episode 7.
Yeah, for sure. Rolling along, ain't we?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of upgraded. Got some different mic stands. But we're coming along. Yep. I want to thank all of our new subscribers.
Thank everybody for viewing our content.
We had a great episode last week, and we are slowly but surely improving, because our goal and our mission is to bring health literacy to the community.
Yeah, I think we're doing that.
Subject at a time.
Yep, absolutely.
One subject at a time. And I am happy today we have with us, because it came about, me and my husband began talking. It's in the news. We're talking about monkeypox.
Yeah, that's something on everybody's tongue.
Yeah.
One more thing to worry about.
One more thing. And I have a guest, another guest. Mm-hmm. So we'll be talking to epidemiologist for the CDC Foundation out of North Carolina, Ms. Kendalyn Stevens.
All right.
She's an epidemiologist working for the CDC. She has background in clinical research. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to talk on a host of topics, from monkeypox to the importance of minorities participating in clinical research, because mm-hmm. we understand that there is a lot of medical mistrust.
That's right. Especially in our community.
So without further ado, let's get started.
Let's get going.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Stevens, for being a part of our Black Health Perspective today as we talk about monkeypox. Well, we're going to talk about a couple of things, but we really want to discuss monkeypox, because I just think that so many in our community are not informed. Another thing that makes them fearful. So just to make sure that they're adequately informed and make the smart decisions, or just be well prepared. Okay. So yeah, right. I want to jump right into it, because I don't think that a lot of people in our audience actually knows what an epidemiologist is. So can you give us a brief description of what you do and what your role is?
Right. So to put it very, I guess in a nutshell, an epidemiologist is basically a public health detective. A lot of what I do and what other epidemiologists will do, it could be in different fields, dealing with different diseases, but specifically what I do is I work with surveillance. So the detective portion, I guess, of being an epidemiologist is you want to, you know, figure out what's the trends with the disease. Like, why is this happening? Why is there an outbreak? Why is lung cancer prevalent in a rural area? All of those things kind of encompass what the role of an epidemiologist is. So the first part is surveillance, right? Because you don't know what's happening if you're not keeping up with data and keeping up with, you know, the cases that are happening in any particular disease, especially with communicable diseases. And as you mentioned, monkeypox, which is definitely a notifiable disease that we do surveillance on. So the surveillance portion is what I work on. I work in a database where I look at cases a lot and basically look at the trends. Like, if there's an outbreak, you can kind of see, especially with monkeypox, because monkeypox isn't supposed to be in the US. So just one case is an outbreak in the US. So just basically doing surveillance, looking at the database. I run a lot of reports because I work with the healthcare-associated infections. So basically, I look at trends at our hospitals all over the state and look to see what infections throughout the hospital are trending upward and which ones are trending downward. And then provide guidance to the hospitals to see how they can, you know, decrease infections, or, you know, basically tell them, hey, you're doing a good job on whatever you're doing. Can you show other hospitals what you're doing?
All righty. So just to give our audience a little clarification, you are based out of where?
So I'm based out of North Carolina.
Okay, so you're doing surveillance for local hospitals to see trends with different disease and their processes in the North Carolina area, but there are epidemiologists in every state. So I just want to give some clarification to them. Okay.
And not only are they all over, they're in all states, but also within the healthcare field, they're embedded in the local hospitals. They can be in your hospital, they can be in your local health departments.
Okay. So let me ask you, me and my husband, we like to watch movies. So I'm steering off just from one of the questions. So when COVID occurred, we had time off because we were quarantined, you know, many people were working from home. Yeah. Right. And we looked at what was contagion
and outbreak.
So and it kind of gave us a whole
perspective on how
it just was a whole different perspective. Is that similar? Some of the duties that the actors played in the role in the different roles, is that similar to what you would do, or
kind of a detective work?
Actually, I don't remember. I feel like I've seen those movies, but I don't remember what all happened in the movies.
Oh, you have look, I will tell you, got to go back and watch it, because when COVID hit, we were there.
So basically, it was an outbreak of whatever it was, and they had folks who were doing surveillance and doing contact tracing, trying to figure out the origin of the contagion and how to contain it, how it was spread, and all those type of things. So,
right,
I was kind of wondering if that's basically the gist of what you do.
That is definitely a part of what an epidemiologist does. And like with any field, there's so many different types of epidemiologists. You have your epidemiologists that work out in the field, and they would definitely be the ones that would probably be more set for the movie set with, you know, actually going out and, you know, collecting samples and creating surveys. And usually, you know, people, when we think of epidemiologists, is they want to know the what, when, where, and how. So, you know, basically, you know, kind of, but specifically for myself, I'm not a field epidemiologist. I work more so with the data. And, you know, you'll have throughout like the different diseases, you will have, trying to think, like maybe if you were a foodborne epidemiologist, where there's, you know, salmonella outbreaks and you know, any kind of foodborne disease outbreak, then those are kind of more the ones that's more hands-on, like out in the field.
Okay, so because I think recently in the news there's something out west, I believe it was out west, I don't know if it was salmonella or an E. coli outbreak.
Salmonella and E. coli is always happening, always.
Oh, okay.
so I'm sure.
So let me ask you, as a minority epidemiologist, does that allow you to evaluate or see the data differently? Like, for instance, when COVID hit and you were evaluating the data and knowing that we began to hear reports that minorities or individuals with comorbidities, and knowing, especially, you know, I know for me, when COVID and they were beginning to say who were most at risk for contract or not recovering well from COVID, it would be those individuals with comorbidities. And you just, I just thought about, wow, the South, like that Bible Belt South of Southern eating and just not having accessibility to healthcare. Does it allow you to see the data from that lens as an epidemiologist?
Right. So as a Black woman, I see everything through the lens of a Black woman. And definitely as a Black epidemiologist. And I think I would like to think it's a benefit because, you know, it's one thing to read about culture, but it's another to be a part of the culture, right? So with COVID, just thinking about one, like, you know, we discussed before about, you know, COVID vaccine rates being low among the Black community in the beginning because of the mistrust, you know, that the Black community has with healthcare and particularly with research. So I already knew that that was going to be a struggle because, you know, we have our reasons for it. But I also know that as a, you know, as a Black woman in public health, that we need to be a part of this, you know, research and be a part of anything dealing with vaccine trials because we make up the population, right? And so we want to know how things affect us. You know, things affect us differently. Like we have a different diet sometimes than, you know, other cultures. Our lifestyles are different than other cultures. Our, you know, the community that we live in, who we live with, the fact that we live with, you know, sometimes we live with extended family. We live with grandma, grandpa, uncle, you know, all of those things kind of factor into, you know, any kind of outbreak, and especially with COVID. So definitely, like everything that I look at, whether it be like maternal health, maternal morbidity when it comes to Black women, everything I look through with the lens of a Black woman. And that's definitely why I decided to work in public health, because not only do I want to help move, you know, public health forward, but I also want to be able to contribute to the Black community because I am a Black woman. And my kids are Black.
Okay. Do you feel as though the work that you do is getting through to our community in terms of our community receiving this information and becoming less hesitant about vaccines or about treatments or anything of that nature?
I think so. I briefly worked on a COVID vaccine trial and as a clinical research coordinator. And I worked on one on a military post. And surprisingly, like when we were doing outreach and trying to let people know that about the research trial, that there were a lot of Black participants. And, you know, without giving, you know, giving them the information, going over the informed consent, but they were interested. And I think they were interested because they were scared, you know, COVID was so new.
Yeah. See, I had the opposite experience. Mm. I also, you know, we have discussed privately, you know, we have discussed offline that I work in clinical research now, but I also work clinical research during the COVID trials. And like I said, I even experienced some, unfortunately, some social media backlash. And I was like, you couldn't even really see me on the camera, but they noticed me. And so, but I understand, like you say, you understand the mistrust. Even as my colleagues at the job were like, hey, we need more minority participants. I was like, I'm gonna be honest. I was like, we're not coming, because I do understand. But then I also noticed that the population of individuals who were participating in the trial here were, you don't want, they were Caucasian. They were very well educated in the medical community. Cause I was at one point, I was like, is there something I don't know? I mean, to actually see physicians sitting there waiting for for a couple of hours, just reading their papers and not complaining about the time to participate in these trials, it was like, it made me go, you know? So, but to know that our community just was not, for here in Savannah, I did not see that participation that you speak of, you know, where you were located.
Right. And I mean, I think, and it could be because it was military families. So, you know, the mindset might be a little bit different. But yeah, I think we had, it was a decent, it was more than what I thought. I'll say that. Okay. It was more than what I was expecting. But I think at the end of the day, like COVID, I mean, being that it was so new, I think people were starting to see that, okay, we're dying from this, and yes, they wanted to protect themselves. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you're going to do what you have to do, you know, to protect you and your family. So I think as scared as people were about the vaccine, I think they were probably a little bit more scared of COVID.
That is true, especially as the different variants came about. Right. I can't recall if it was the Delta variant, because I think the Delta variant seemed to really.
Yeah, I think that one just kind of kicked in really, really hard,
especially for the Savannah area. Yes. And it was right. Sad. It was quite sad. So now we're on to another, I don't want to call it a pandemic, but another outbreak, and that's monkeypox.
Right.
So let's talk about monkeypox. So I did some background research, and I could be wrong, but I see that monkeypox first emerged in humans in the 1970s. So it's not a new virus.
Right.
But what has caused this particular spread? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, I say that to say some of the same behaviors that have been existent over the last few decades still exist. Right. What about this particular spread that has made it prevalent to where we're seeing it on the news?
Yeah, you mentioned that it's not supposed to be in the United States. So what happened?
Right. So, and let me preface this by saying I am not a microbiologist. So I don't know the, I guess, down to like the specifics of monkeypox. But what I can say, only because I work somewhat with it, I see it, you know, in my position. But so with this particular spread, so like I mentioned, monkeypox is typically in different countries in Africa, and it's what you would call endemic, meaning that it's normal kind of for it to be there, right? It's not anything new. They've experienced it. It's not, you know, a disease that's running rampant or anything. And matter of fact, there's more cases outside of Africa of monkeypox than there is in Africa now. So I think the main idea for this outbreak is that it started with a traveler. A man visited Nigeria, and he went to, I believe, a European country. I'm not sure the particular one. And he attended a rave, you know, which is where there's a lot of sex, drugs, just partying, sex with multiple partners, came back to the US, and basically kind of, you know, did the same activities in the US, and spread it to different partners. I guess you could call it partners. And then that's how it began to spread here in the US. And it's kind of continued because I believe that one person that had it in the US attended a rave, also kind of doing the same thing. But then I think the idea with raves is that a lot of times it's with anonymous, you know, it's anonymous, like you don't know the names of the people, so you can't contact them once, you know, you find out you have monkeypox. You can't reach back out and say, hey, go get tested or anything. So it kind of
it kind of hinders the surveillance for on your part to do the, like the contact tracing.
Right.
So I have a question before that, but I want to go into the fact that, you know, the media, I think, and me and you discussed this on the phone when we discussed, like, the media portrays, I think the image that individuals get is that it's only because it was spread through male-to-male contact, but it's a higher prevalence amongst that group of individuals who participate in risky behaviors, because you have individuals who do not participate in that risky behavior. So I feel like that it's a stigma out there, but not based upon, it's not realizing it's because these individuals participated in risky behaviors.
It's not just solely because of homosexual behavior.
Right.
You know, it's risky behavior. And I think the media tends to lump risky behaviors into one specific group, which is unfair.
Right.
So I think what we want to get people to understand is, I don't know if the data shows that it's particularly high in that particular.
It is, but I was thinking.
It's I think it's unfair to just kind of generalize it, and you know, that it's risky behavior as opposed to one specific group of risky behavior.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. And it's kind of a slippery slope, because it's like you want to point out the population that's at risk, but at the same time, you don't want to alienate people, you know, and make them feel, you know, uncomfortable, I guess. Yeah. Right. But I can say for North Carolina, and I'm not even sure where the data is this week, because it changes every day. But I know as of last week, all of our cases were men that were either gay, bi, or men that had sex with men, what we call MSMs, men that have sex with men. So that's where it is right now. But can that change? Absolutely. And it's not because of, you know, it's not, I don't think it's within the gay community just because they're gay. It's just because of some of that behaviors. Some of, I believe some of the men have multiple partners. Some of them, you know, have are on social media and going to like these websites, dating sites, and you know, basically having sex, and they don't know their names. And like I mentioned, you know, it's kind of hard to relay information if you don't know the person's name that you're, you know, partnering with. Yeah,
I know. And the only reason why I wanted to bring that up is because, like you say, unfortunately, it's most prevalent in that demographic. But it's not because of that demographic. And I think that sometimes we as society is like, that's for them, so that doesn't involve me. And you need to be, because if that demographic of those particular men are involved in risky behavior, then if they interact with other individuals, maybe I'll just use an example. If it was a drug addict type of demographic, individuals who are more, you know, prone to, and they were involved in that risky behavior, see how it just goes over to from one group to the next. Am I making sense? So, and I just want everyone to be precautious, like, oh, that does not mean, that means I won't get it. But no, you still have to be precautious, you know. Precautionary measures.
It's not exclusive.
It's not exclusive.
Everybody's at risk, whether you're involved in this specifically risky behavior or not. It's still something you need to take precautions against.
Correct.
Right, because anybody, you know, anybody can get monkeypox. Like, it's not, you know, it's not for any particular person. You know, I know, I'm sure you've seen like the pictures where they have the lesions and, you know, those are infectious. So if you touch those lesions, if you come in contact with anything pertaining to that lesion, whether it's their skin falling off or any of that, that's infectious. And so, you know, anybody that touches that, anybody who comes in contact with their sheets, because the skin is constantly shedding, any of those things, you can get it as well by doing that. So it's not, you know, it's not a, just their problem. It's anybody's problem.
It's a problem.
Yeah. Right. If you come in contact with it.
So the CDC says that it typically lasts about 2 to 4 weeks. Are mm-hmm. you contagious the entire time, or are once your lesions have scaled over, or like when
does it become non-infectious?
Just, yes.
Right. So it said, according to CDC's guidelines, once the new layer of skin grows in under that lesion, once the crust has like fallen off and new skin has formed, then that part is no longer, you know, infectious. But, you know, sometimes with those lesions, there can be 30 plus lesions. So you'd have to, you know, make sure all of those have healed. Yes.
So let me, are you infectious prior to formation of lesion?
I believe so. I'm not 100% sure. I know that you can definitely transmit it. It's definitely transmitted through the lesions. I think that they say that you can it's transmitted also through like respiratory secretion. So like through kissing, you know, saliva, okay. all that, but it has to be for a prolonged amount of time. So I'm not sure if it's transmitted prior to seeing the lesions, if it could be transmitted, you know, through respiratory secretions. I'm not sure about that. But I think definitely with this outbreak, because a lot of it, is more, you know, in the genital region. I think it's more of the transmission is occurring during sex, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that makes that kind of ties it. You see it more in that population, well, in that group of individuals who are practicing risky behavior. And then they have the lesions, so they're going to have, if they're participating in having multiple partners. Okay, that makes sense.
Right, yeah. And then also another thing, I know like in the beginning, a lot, I remember like, I believe it was the fourth case, and I saw him like on a CDC webinar, and I know he was willing to do an interview with CDC, you know, to give out, you know, outreach, for outreach. And he was actually co-infected with, I believe, gonorrhea or syphilis one. So it's definitely like more of kind of behavioral things, like, you know, your actions more so than, and he'd had, I think it was gonorrhea or syphilis before. So it wasn't his first time. Right. So, risk behavior once again.
Are we talking about the individual they traced back to being patient zero?
No, she said patient number four.
Okay. Oh yeah, I believe it was like, yeah, one of the cases was discovered. Yeah. Okay.
So since COVID, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, are we seeing an increase in virus outbreaks, or are they always been this common and we are just becoming
more aware?
Right, so I think it's a little bit of both. I think definitely with social media, you know, we're more aware of things than we probably would have been like 20, 30 years ago. Because you take like issues like E. coli, salmonella, like I mentioned, foodborne diseases, those have always been there. You know, it's just one of those things that people don't talk about as much. But there is, I mean, the world is changing. You have the climate's changing. You have the use of antibiotics over like what? Has it been like 50 years, 50, 70 years maybe of antibiotic use?
So we're becoming more.
Right, so you know.
resistant to antibiotics.
Right, yeah.
So and a lot of people don't know that we're becoming more resistant to antibiotics. I think
we're our own worst enemy as well, because we tend to go to the doctor and they feel bad and say, oh, I want an antibiotic for this, or I feel like I need an antibiotic for that, and they get them and this resistance develops.
And we're kind of almost,
and then we're not completing the antibiotic course therapy like you're supposed to.
Yeah.
So I guess our last, because you mentioned in the beginning that your role is a detective, and you encourage individuals, especially Black individuals, how we need to participate in trial studies and vaccine studies so that we can have adequate data. But with a long-standing history of medical mistrust, and even just to hear it throughout the news now, when you talk about maternal health, it's now almost fearful for a family member to go to the hospital, especially for Blacks. I'm just speaking honestly, you know. What are some pieces that we can put in from the medical community to help build trust to?
That's a good question.
Yes, because it takes a lot of work.
I think now with the younger generation, it's a little easier to, I don't want to say convince is the right word, but they haven't gone through the trauma that our parents and grandparents went through.
Or we.
You know, and we still go through, but certainly not to the extent of like the Tuskegee experiment.
Correct.
Kind of thing. You know, so there is that mistrust, and certainly we're not treated the same as a community as other communities are. So that mistrust is still there to some degree. But, you know, what do you think, in your opinion, is a good way to kind of alleviate some of that mistrust?
Yeah, I bridge that gap, you know.
So, and I know we spoke about it on the phone too. We had a good conversation on the phone.
We did.
but I think two major ways is one, like I mentioned, you build trust with your healthcare practitioner, you know, your primary care doctor. You go to them when you're sick, you know, for anything else, whether it be, you know, your wellness checkups or, you know, breast cancer screenings, whatever. You go to your primary care. So when it comes to anything that's new or that you're hesitant about or that you want more information about, I think that especially for the Black community, go to your primary care, establish a relationship with your primary care doctor. If you don't have one, establish one, because there's someone that can follow you, you know, throughout the years, and they'll know, you know, more about you, more about your history, your family history. And I think that we definitely have gotten away from that. You know, it used to be, and not that I'm like the oldest person in the world, but it used to be that, you know, people had more of a relationship with their doctors. And I think, you know, we've kind of gotten away from that, especially with the way that the healthcare system is set up. You know, you kind of get away from that, but it's extremely important, I think, for us to have that relationship with a primary care doctor so that they can be the one that gives you advice. And then also to be a part of that community, you know, definitely we need more Black doctors. We need more Black epidemiologists. We need more Black nurses, Black people in public health, Black people in research, you know, all of those things, because even for myself, like when I go into the doctor, it comforts me to see another Black woman, you know, that's taking care of me, you know? So I just think that we definitely need to, you know, invest more in making sure the youth is, you know, interested in these type of careers and, you know, seeing them through and, you know, letting them know that.
Yeah, that's a great point in regards to making sure our youth are interested in health related fields, and just understand there's more than just a nurse, there's epidemiologists there, right. You know,
They're scientists.
They're scientists.
In a lab. Yeah.
Right. Of
folks and young kids into more into STEM, into a medical track, like in high school, they have those. And like I said, move on to bigger and better things.
Right. You know.
Trying to diminish nursing or anything of that nature, but like epidemiology.
Well, I mean,
being a doctor, like being public health, like you said, and all these different.
These important roles, because like you said, establishing a relationship with a primary care physician, it is great. But if we think about how many in our community are not connected to a primary care doctor, not due because they're not wanting to, they just don't have the accessibility to.
To
get to a primary care. So
we had a good podcast on that last week, so check it out.
So it has been, I mean, thank you for all our little technical difficulties, but it has been great talking to you. I'm happy that you have debunked some myths out there and given a broader lens to how we deal with monkeypox or misconceptions, and then just explaining what you do, that you are really, as I read, the disease detective, you know? And currently you work with the CDC now, correct?
Right. The CDC Foundation.
Okay. So thank you again. We may be calling, like I'll tell all the guests, I may be calling on you again. So if you don't mind.
Oh no, that's totally fine. Look, hopefully it won't be another outbreak though.
That is true. And then, you know, I'll reach back out to you and ask you, have you watched Contagion yet? You know, it's an old movie, but it was an eye opener for me.
I feel like I have, I just don't remember it.
Oh, it was something else for me.
It made you take a second look and try to understand how these things proliferate and how they spread and how easy it is just to go from one person to the next person without even thinking about it. This is something as simple as a handshake.
Right.
You know, and it just blows up. And I think once we understand that aspect, we can understand better how to protect ourselves and our families. And then,
Also do better mitigation when it comes to outbreaks, because I don't feel like we did a good mitigation prepared beforehand with COVID, but that's just my opinion.
Right. Well, and one thing that I definitely wanted to mention is that with outbreaks, you have to think about global health. Like, there's no such thing as, okay, that's an issue for that country and not for my country, because you see how easily it can travel, you know, with airplanes flying, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe flights a day, you know. A disease can be here, you know, at one end of the country and then another country in the same day. So
within an hour, you know. And that's why I said I don't too much agree with how we mitigate it for COVID, but it's a learning experience, you know, and something that we hopefully we learn from.
I know we learn what we learn, and we know how to keep it, you know, somewhat contained, but the powers that be are the ones that really need to kind of take it all in and do better at mitigating any new outbreak. I mean, even the stuff that's not new, it's back, you know, and it can spread just like anything else can. So,
Oh, one last question. So it's about monkeypox, and I know that's, it's probably taken, and I'm gonna let you go, cause I do appreciate this. So I did read that if you were, there's no true treatment for monkeypox, but it is the similar treatment for smallpox. So I guess this is one misconception. If you know those individuals who have the little markers from where they receive the smallpox vaccine, does that make them less susceptible to monkeypox, or
is that a true thing or
is that a myth?
Well, it's a true thing, but I think they do not know how much it helps though. Like, it helps, it provides some amount of protection, but they're not sure how much. So it's still probably best to, you know, just stay away from lesions. Okay. But it does. There are two vaccines that I know that they're giving to the population that's at risk. And there's a research treatment. It's a treatment for smallpox, but they're using it, I think, as on a research basis as a treatment to prevent it from becoming severe, like extremely severe. And I don't think monkeypox usually gets that severe, but in the case that I guess it, gets to a certain point, they can use it. But it is in the research phase. And I think I saw that you still have to do like an informed consent in order to even receive that treatment. So.
Yeah. Well, again, I think we got all our questions.
Yeah. Well, one did just pop into my head, if you don't mind. As far as treatments go, the big thing, I guess, is just, the care of the lesions and how long that may take, and anywhere from 2 weeks to however long it takes, however many lesions to heal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And during that period, all those are infectious. So I imagine that is the hardest part of the treatment, since there is really no quote unquote treatment. It's just being vigilant about, your possibility of exposure to other folks. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, some patients do have like complications from monkeypox. So it's not just with the lesions healing. Like some people are actually, I believe there have been some deaths from monkeypox, but it's, other complications that arise, not necessarily from the lesions, but it could be like the placement of the lesions. Like I mentioned in this outbreak, a lot of them are in the genital area. And I know there was one of the cases said that he went to I believe it was like that fourth case that I mentioned earlier. I know he was saying that he went to the emergency room because he was unable to urinate. And that can become a whole issue, if you can't do that.
Yeah.
So. Well, yeah, I think other complications happen because, it's swelling. The lesions were swelling, and in that region, it's just not
right.
It's not good. So,
okay. Well, I thank you so again. I thank you. This has been a great topic. Mm-hmm. And I would love to have you back on because you did mention about sexually transmitted diseases, and I know in October it is. Sexual Health Awareness Month. So I'll talk to you about that on another time, but because that is really a very passionate topic of mine. But I do thank you. I thank you so much. Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you
for having me.
No, thank you.
We appreciate you.
Thank you. We appreciate you for coming.
Okay.
All right. An excellent episode.
Yeah, I think it came together pretty well.
It did.
A lot of information. More than we know more now than we did when we started.
Yeah. I think my goal with this episode was just debunking some misconceptions about monkeypox, mm-hmm. to the fact that we all have to be vigilant and use safety precautions. And understand why one is not, I don't think it's a target of one population, right. But more of this population is being more affected and this is why.
Right.
But it kind of stigmatizes and group that whole population when that's not necessarily the case. And I hope we've done that some today.
I think so. Just to understand is that we all need to be careful. And be preventative and it does affect us all.
Yes. We did bring up, which we'll talk about again on other episodes, the importance of we have to build some trust in our medical community.
Yep.
But the exactly what epidemiologists and their surveillance and how our data is important to is an important part with detecting or surveillancing a certain disease processes. Yeah. But like I say, always, I'm just astounded by the individuals that I meet along this journey who are willing and open to share their knowledge.
Yeah, that's been a blessing for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So hope you all enjoyed it. Hope you all take something away from it.
Like.
Share. subscribe.
Warren, you got to help me one more time, and then I'm going to, what is it, sweetie?
So it's, if you like the video, if you enjoyed the video, hit the like button. If you want to see more of our content, hit the subscribe button. And to never miss a video, hit the notification bell.
All right.
Okay.
So if you like what you saw, hit that like button. If you want to see more content, subscribe.
And hit the bell so you'll be notified and you'll never miss an episode.
There you go. And we are going to work on our social media content. Like, we're trying to make some reels, but
it's coming.
Yeah. Episode 7 in the books.
Baby. There it is. Keep it up.
Thank you for tuning in to the Black Health Perspective. We'll see you next time.
All right. Take care.